Today is Thursday, May 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As countries begin to reopen, what lessons need to be learned?
Early action was really essential for many of these countries.
Plus, the United States and China continue their diplomatic back and forth.
Here's how this could get solved really quickly. The Chinese Communist Party could do what they're committed to do.
And a look ahead to VE Day. Those stories and more next. The United Nations is boosting its appeal for billions of dollars in coronavirus aid, saying the money is necessary to protect millions of lives and help stop the spread of the virus in fragile countries. The UN's humanitarian office said on Thursday the world's poorest countries are not expected to experience the peak of COVID-19 until sometime in the next 3 to 6 months, that already those areas are seeing lost jobs and income, as well as tighter food supplies and children going without vaccinations. An earlier appeal asked for $2 billion in funding, and the agency said Thursday it needs a total of $6.7 billion. There are about 3.8 million confirmed cases worldwide, with 264,000 deaths. After weeks and sometimes months, countries around the globe are starting the process of relaxing stay-at-home orders and trying to figure out the best way to restart their economies. The way they do so may depend on how severely the COVID-19 pandemic has affected their nation and how they responded. Kelly Magsamen is the Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, a nonpartisan research and educational institute in Washington. I spoke to her via Skype about what the United States could learn from other nations moving forward.
Well, we took a look at about 9 countries across both Europe and Asia. As we were looking at a number of countries like New Zealand and Germany and South Korea that were just starting to reopen, we wanted to sort of assess whether or not there were some common factors that allowed them to be successful and put them in a place to reopen. I would say we learned a few things. First is that early action was really essential for many of these countries to put them in the position where they are now to be able to reopen. And so what I mean by early action is, you know, very early lockdowns. In the case of New Zealand, for example, New Zealand issued lockdowns well before they even had any deaths. You know, South Korea and Germany implemented very early testing sort of across the board. Germany actually was already doing about 350,000 tests per week by April. So really early national comprehensive effort was really required to put these countries in the place where they are now to be successful. Some of the other cases that were less successful had challenges in that regard, especially Italy and, of course, as you see, are seeing now the United States, which lost a considerable amount of time early on in terms of a national comprehensive strategy. So that was one of the real early lessons. The second thing that we're learning is that it's really hard to divorce economic recovery from the public health strategy and response. It's very clear that those countries that are in a successful position to reopen really went early, went hard, testing, contact tracing.
That seems to be the mantra, testing. So moving forward, what kind of recommendations can be made in terms of governments who are looking to reopen, and what should they be on the lookout for should there be a resurgence of COVID-19 cases?
I think we should, and what our research has shown is that we should expect sort of second waves, third waves. If you look at the case of Singapore, for example, it looked very successful early on in tackling the virus spread. And of course, it's had a resurgence among its migrant communities who are very vulnerable and who live in very close quarters. So it's been difficult to control the spread of the virus. So I think countries, local governments, states all need to be prepared for second waves, and what they need to have put in place some criteria and thresholds for what they would do to potentially reinvest in a lockdown or reconsider additional measures to take. But I do think at the core of this is it's a testing challenge. We're not going to be able to do much of this unless we're able to test in a widespread manner.
Kelly Magsamen is the Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. U.S. lawmakers returning to Washington from their break are renewing their focus on how the Trump administration has responded to the coronavirus outbreak. President Trump blocked the nation's top infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci, from testifying before the Democratic-controlled U.S. House on Wednesday, even though he's set to appear in the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate next week. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the political debate over the pandemic response.
As some U.S. states begin to relax lockdown measures, a warning to lawmakers about the country's death toll.
There will be, tragically, at least 100,000 deaths from COVID by the end of this month.
With Congress back at work in Washington, more questions about the country's response to the pandemic.
Should the country be reopening now? Are we ready? Is it irresponsible to open the economy without adequate testing?
Demonstrators around the country protesting coronavirus closures, visible signs of the country's larger debate over the balance between public health and preventing an economic collapse.
Even though the fight against COVID-19 is far from over, keeping businesses closed and workers at home is not a sustainable option for the long term. Our economies need to get moving again, and Americans need to get back to work.
Public health experts say that's possible with the right resources.
Even as we move towards reopening and as some states make that decision, we still need to be focusing on increasing our capacities to do diagnostic testing and to do contact tracing. Mm-hmm. The window we have to implement those interventions is still open.
Congressional Democrats say the Trump administration has no nationwide testing strategy and failed to supply personal protective equipment to healthcare personnel. President Trump told ABC News he blames former President Obama for the lack of resources.
The last administration left us nothing. We didn't have ventilators. We didn't have medical equipment. We didn't have testing.
Those claims will receive more scrutiny next week as Democrats ramp up investigations into the White House response and hear more about a top government scientist complaint. Dr. Rick Bright is set to testify President Trump misled the public when he claimed a malaria drug was a cure for the coronavirus. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump vetoed the Iran War Powers Resolution on Wednesday. The bill would have limited the president's ability to wage war against Iran as he wages a campaign of maximum pressure against the country. Reuters reporter Gloria So has more.
It was the latest effort by Congress to wrestle back from the White House its constitutionally guaranteed authority to declare military action as Trump wages a campaign of maximum pressure against Iran. It had passed through both the House and Senate and had support from Democrats and some Republicans. In a statement released by the White House, Trump called it a, quote, insulting resolution, accusing Democrats of using it to divide Republicans and try to win back the White House in November. And he added that, quote, the few Republicans who voted for it played right into their hands. The resolution would have required Trump to remove U.S. troops engaged in hostilities against Iran unless Congress declared war or specifically authorized the use of military force. The measure sought to rebuke Trump after he authorized a strike which killed Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani and later sparked retaliation from Iran, stoking fears of broader regional conflict. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who first introduced the bill, tweeted shortly after Trump's veto, urging his colleagues to join him in voting to override it, saying, quote, Congress must vote before sending our troops into harm's way. Trump's fellow Republicans hold a majority in the Senate, which is expected to hold a veto override vote as early as Thursday. While a handful of Republicans in both houses of Congress supported the measure when it passed, they're not enough to muster the two-thirds majority needed to override a veto.
That was Reuters' Gloria So reporting. And coming up later,
a lot of decisions by individuals, individual presidents, individuals on battlefields, ship commanders.
The threat of Nazism led to a partnership of unlikely allies.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. One of the most destructive volcanic eruption events in recent history took place when Hawaii's Kilauea erupted from early May through early September 2018. A new study from researchers at the University of Miami in Florida suggests that the 2018 eruption was likely triggered by extended and occasionally extreme rainfall in the months prior to the event. Using rainfall measurements, the researchers examined the fluid pressure within the volcano structure over time, which they say is a factor that can affect the chances for mechanical failure in the ground subsurface, driving volcanic activity. They found that fluid pressure at the site just before the eruption was at its highest in almost half a century, and proposed that this expedited movement of magma beneath the volcano. The U.S. Geological Survey says about 22 square kilometers of land was flooded by lava during the event. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Top U.S. and Chinese officials continued their sharp exchanges over the origins and response during the early days of the coronavirus outbreak. Beijing is accusing Secretary of State Mike Pompeo of playing politics, claiming COVID-19 originated in a Wuhan lab. Pompeo is pressing for more information. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has that story.
There appears to be no argument the coronavirus outbreak began in Wuhan. The dispute is how it happened. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo faced intense questioning from reporters over his recent remarks that there is enormous evidence the virus originated in a Wuhan lab.
Here's how this could get solved really quickly. The Chinese Communist Party could do what they're committed to do under their obligation to the World Health Organization, to be transparent, to be open, to do the simple things that nations all around the world do to make sure that pandemics like this don't get out of control.
Meanwhile, in Beijing, China's foreign ministry once again denounced Pompeo for his remarks, accusing him of playing domestic politics.
Mr. Pompeo spoke repeatedly, but he has never presented evidence because there was just no such thing. So I think that this question should be left to scientists and medical control experts to answer, and the politicians should not keep lying on this issue for the needs of domestic politics.
Other countries want more information about the virus outbreak in Wuhan, including Germany, Britain, and Australia. Pompeo said Wednesday China should let its scientists come forward.
China is still refusing to share the information we need to keep people safe, such as viral isolates, clinical specimens, and details about the many COVID-19 patients in December 2019, not to mention patient zero.
Pompeo said his calls for transparency from China are not about politics, but about saving lives. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The United States says it intends to grant Iraq a 120-day sanctions waiver, enabling the country to import Iranian gas and electricity to meet power needs. The exemption would be the longest time period given to Iraq in months to prove it is making progress in becoming less reliant on Iranian imports. That's a key condition to qualify for the waiver. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi was sworn in after lawmakers approved the majority of his cabinet appointees overnight on Thursday. An Australian inquiry says Cardinal George Pell knew a priest had been moved decades ago because he had sexually abused children and should have suspended an unstable priest in another parish. A report from the inquiry on child sexual abuse was released in 2017, but findings concerning Pell had been redacted to avoid prejudicing juries. The government released the full report after the High Court overturned convictions against Pell on charges that he molested two choir boys in the late 1990s. Pell had told the inquiry he was deceived and lied to about the two priests, but the report found that implausible. The World Health Organization says calls to domestic violence hotlines in Europe are up as much as 60%. It says alcohol and drug abuse combined with close confinement and coronavirus lockdowns are fueling abuse of the most vulnerable. WHO Regional Director for Europe Hans Klug said the stress and anxiety bred by weeks of restrictions on public life have made uncertainty, separation, and fear part of daily life for many. Rights groups, such as Human Rights Watch, have decried the Philippine government's failure to renew national broadcaster ABS-CBN's franchise license, effectively removing the country's largest network from traditional airwaves. I spoke with Quezon City-based journalist Stanley Gahete via Skype to get the latest reactions from Filipinos and what the network is doing to continue broadcasting.
2 days after the largest television broadcasting network in the Philippines went off the air, the ABS-CBN returned on air today, May 7, via its English cable station, ABS-CBN News Channel, or ANC. Also airing on new media platform and through its global channel, which is the Filipino Channel, or PFC. Aside from television broadcast, ABS-CBN is now maximizing its digital platforms, doing live stream on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and even on its website and via its mobile app, since these platforms are not part of the congressional franchise that expired this year. Through its program flagship TV Patrol, the primetime newscast of the said television channel aired again, presenting current news events including current issues on COVID-19 pandemic. Thursday morning, the reporters, writers, producers, directors, production staff, and news anchors went back to their regular duties as if everything is normal.
So what's been some of the reaction from either politicians or the general public?
Celebrities of ABS-CBN also shared their sentiments while showing support after the said TV network went black on screen last Tuesday. Meanwhile, world boxing icon and Senator Manny Pacquiao on Wednesday said that the NTC should keep its promise to give ABS-CBN provisional permit to operate pending final congressional action on the network's franchise bid.
Originally, when this first happened, there wasn't any immediate response from ABS-CBN management. What can you give us as far as an update as to their courses of action?
ABS-CBN also today filed a 46-page petition to Supreme Court asking to stop the NTC's cease and desist order given last May 5. Since all lower courts' offices are physically closed due to COVID-19 pandemic, the ABS-CBN filed directly to Supreme Court to quickly process and resolve the issue on air. The Supreme Court will have a special session tomorrow and expected to discuss such important matters, including the television franchise renewal. Meanwhile, President Rodrigo Duterte decries reports linking him to ABS-CBN shutdown on Thursday. According to the Malacanang Palace, reports linking to the president to the shutdown of the broadcast operations were totally unfair and objectionable. The palace said it distanced the chief executive from the order of the regulators and the franchise is up to Congress.
The franchising license only covers the airwaves in the Philippines, but not the cable channels, not social media, streaming platforms, etc. And it's an interesting way that ABS-CBN is going about continuing broadcasting the news.
I think, Steve, ABS-CBN planned also already this years before because they expected that this will happen since President Rodrigo Duterte was showing dismay on ABS-CBN after it did not air its election campaign.
Stanley Gahete is a reporter based in Quezon City in the Philippines. The European Commission this week forecast the worst economic outlook in recent history, wiping out any signs of recovery from the last financial crisis. Journalist Nicolas Pinot is based in Paris, and I spoke with him via WhatsApp to get the details.
Well, as the European Union simply put it, this is the worst economic shock since the Great Depression in the 1930s. So it's pretty severe. I mean, Italy, Spain, and Greece all face economic contractions of more than 9% this year for their GDP, according to the European Commission. And obviously, these countries, they're going to have some spending programs. But of course, the situation is really bad. Like for France, where I'm right now located, you have more than 12 million private employees who are without jobs.
So moving forward, I mean, have governments within the EU bloc come up with any kind of plans to mitigate the situation? Because there is going to be no quick fix.
Yeah, if you remember, 2 weeks ago, discussions were ongoing in Brussels between head of states for a plan about $1.6 trillion to rescue the economy in the region. So far, leaders are still talking to come up with a plan, but you have also some measures, such like France, to support unemployment. And we call here in France temporary unemployment, which basically the state is paying for 80% of the salary for companies that had to shut down because of the lockdown or because of the pandemic. So, and you have also some programs with loans to help business to stay afloat for the past 2 months. It's been very, very complicated across the region.
Now, this is also taking on the doorsteps of ongoing discussions with Britain. Britain left the EU at the end of January, and talks are supposed to be underway to finalize a trade agreement by the end of this year. What's the latest on those run of talks? Because this is a trade agreement and will have an impact on trade and the economy in Europe.
Yeah, and UK definitely needs an agreement. As of today, the Bank of England has warned the British economy will shrink by 14% this year. So discussions are still ongoing. The European Union and the UK government, they have until the end of June. This is the deadline for the two sides to agree on any extension of negotiations. And time is running. The main problem for this discussion is fisheries. It's very complicated, and also a trade agreement. That's something that's very difficult. And as of Tuesday, the island's foreign minister, Simon Coveney, he said the two sides look like they were heading for a crisis. So no one is very optimistic for the future of this discussion.
That was reporter Nicolas Pinault speaking to me from Paris, France. 75 years ago tomorrow, May 8th, Nazi Germany surrendered to the Allies. The war in the Pacific would continue for another 3 months, but May 8, 1945, marked the start of a new era in world history. Michael Sullivan looks back on victory in Europe, called VE Day.
The people of the British Commonwealth.
Jubilation at the end of the fighting in Europe, 3 years after the United States had joined the effort. As the world discovered the extent of Nazi atrocities, fierce fighting against Japan continued in the Pacific. More than 60 million people died in the conflict. The Allied victory was not inevitable. Its success came from many large and small decisions.
A lot of decisions by individuals, individual presidents, individuals on battlefields, ship commanders.
The threat of Nazism led to a partnership of unlikely allies.
Talk about disparate, you know, America, Britain, the Soviet Union getting together to destroy Germany and its minions in Europe, and eventually the Japanese Empire as well. It's a great example of how a coalition should work.
After the war, Europe emerged from the ashes, rebuilt in part by the U.S. Marshall Plan and a new desire for European unity.
And a lot of the transformations in Europe, the institutions that we see, came out of both the need to rebuild after World War II and the sense that the Europeans no longer, after the war, felt like they could do it on their own. They had to have help.
For many, the United States became a model.
Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, ich bin ein Berliner.
The U.S. promoted international institutions.
With things like the United Nations, with setting up the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and basically pegging the world economy to the U.S. dollar.
Tensions were heightened in a new Cold War, with the United States pitted against the Soviet Union and Communist China. Today, with the rise of a new nationalism, many countries are turning inward.
There's a question whether traditional American values like free trade are really working in our favor anymore. So there's definitely been a change in attitude from the generation in 1945.
With the loss of much of U.S. manufacturing and facing a pandemic, this is a time of reevaluation.
Now, when we don't have enough drugs being made here in the U.S., when we don't have enough masks, enough protective equipment, we're looking at it and realizing this is a lot like a wartime situation from a production standpoint.
Recalling a day of celebration and unity, now focused on a very different challenge. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a thoughtful Thursday.